This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. But don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred, and the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hello, hello. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and tonight is a very, very special show.
It sure is.
You might have guessed if you've been listening for a long time, or if you just tuned in, you'll have no idea what we're talking about, because tonight is our 2-year anniversary of Is Nothing Sacred. We have been on every Monday night, 10 to 11, for 2 years, no breaks.
Wow.
Commitment.
Oh, that shows you how fabulous we are. And I'm looking around the studio and we are fabulous. Fabulosity has increased too because we've invited one of our original co-hosts, Patrick, to
come back into
the studio to join us tonight. And we've let Claire stay in here even though she hasn't done the whole 2 years. She hasn't done the whole 2 years. We're just going to beat her into submission so that she does.
Thanks so much, Jim.
It's okay.
So tonight we bring you our 104th show. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe we thought we'd run out of topics after the end of the first season. Not at all. We've had a great...
We've still got topics lined up.
We have so much to go. And we also have a few clips from the olden days, a.k.a. 2014, which are coming up later in the show from some of my favourite moments. I did the editing, so it's my favourite moment. Sorry, guys. You do feature in them, both of you. Yes, so a bit of reminiscing, but first up, we're going to be talking to two researchers tonight, Jen and Danny. And first up, we have Jen. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Welcome to Is Nothing Sacred. Now, I'm quite excited to talk to you because I think you, like me, are a fellow biologist of some description.
Yes.
If I understand correctly, your interest is in dirt.
I like dirt. Absolutely.
What do you like about dirt?
What don't I like about dirt? So I study soil microbial ecology. So when
did
I look
your
at
mother have to keep telling you not to put dirt in your mouth when you were a child?
She never stopped telling me. There's every picture of me as a little kid is with dirt on my face. So.
Did you eat slugs and snails?
More flowers and plants, I think.
That's not healthy.
Yeah, no, it was maybe vegetarian sort of kind of diet when I was little, but yeah. So it's soil microbial communities is what I study. So when I look at dirt, I don't just see dirt. I see a whole universe of communities and interactions. And, you know, in 1 gram of dirt, there's something like, I don't know, between 1,000 and 10,000 different species of microorganisms. So my job or my research is to study them all at once and try and work out what they're doing. And
do they have nuclear wars?
Do they what?
Have nuclear wars.
They have biological warfare, which is very cool. They do that in the roots of plants to try and muscle each other out for space.
So what are these organisms that we're talking about? Are they bacteria? Are they little bugs?
Yeah, yep. So when we talk about, I guess, microorganisms, that's anything that you
can't
see.
Tell us the strangest ones.
Oh, the strangest ones. Well, so when I talk about microorganisms, I mean usually bacteria and fungi. There are all sorts of strange and wonderful ones. In our lab, we work with a beautiful one called Geobacter metalli reducens, and it's beautiful because it breathes electricity.
What?
So we can put it in a microbial fuel cell, and it will put electrons onto anodes and cathodes, and we can turn it basically into a living battery. Very, very cool little bug.
Why?
Does it light up?
Yeah, yeah, it will. Well, the bug itself, no, it doesn't light up, but it will. We can make it power LEDs.
So why aren't we all running our houses on bacteria dirt?
It's very, very
because they're going to mutate and take us over.
No, they're not going to mutate on us. I don't think it's more the fact that unless in your house all you need is a little blinking LED. It's probably not quite enough electricity for you. Maybe, not yet, anyway.
Maybe we just don't have enough bacteria.
That could be it. That could be it.
So you said there are lots of species that live in the soil.
Sure.
How do they interact? What are some of the things that happen in these wars?
Well, okay. So, well, the wars are always exciting to talk about. So that's kind of where where our antibiotics come from. So in the soil, microbes use antibiotics to basically muscle out other species of bacteria when they're competing for space. Now, the space that they tend to be competing for is space in the rhizosphere, which is the root zone. So I work a lot with plant-microbe interactions, so that's kind of the front line of these microbial community wars. The reason they really want to be on those roots is because the plants are constantly pumping what we call root exudate, so that's carbon, nitrogen, basically sort of a buffet of food for the bacteria. So everyone wants to be there, but it's pretty expensive real estate.
So root excrement, which is nitrogen and...
exudate, but yeah, excrement, sure. Same difference.
We've talked about poo on this show before, you know.
We had a doctor on the show a couple of months ago who was
poo
talking
pills.
About a treatment where you take someone's poo and you refine the bacteria and then take it as treatment for various gut conditions.
Sure thing. And, you know, they've been talking about that so sort of as a treatment after you've been through major surgery to help you recover. Yeah, no, so some of the work we do, I don't just work with dirt, but myself and some other colleagues also look at microbial communities inside you or me. So I like to call that population genetics. That's pretty much what we're doing. It's good fun.
And what are some of the applications of this kind of work?
So in terms of the soil stuff, which is what really interests me, so I'm really interested in trying to work out, can we get, we know that in the soil there are microbes that promote plant growth. Can we get any soil to sort of promote plant growth for us? We know these plant growth promoting microbes are everywhere. How do we kind of switch them on? So the applications of this are manifold. You can imagine, you know...
You mean turn the deserts into oases?
Well, that might be a little bit extreme, but it would be really nice to be able to go around Australia and say, okay, let's look at this soil. How do we get the maximum productivity out of this soil and maybe reduce sort of maybe some of our fertiliser input?
Well, Barnaby Joyce is going to love you.
That's good. So the other application I'm interested in, which you guys were talking to me about before, was phytoremediation. So this is, you know, when we have soil that has contaminants in it, so something like heavy metals, which are really hard to move. And we know there are trees out there that can not only withstand these heavy metal toxins, but they've evolved to actually actively suck the metals up out of the soil and store them in their leaves. So it's a pretty inefficient process. But we do know if we put microbes with these plants that promote the plant growth, the whole phytoremediation process gets sped up. So part of my research is trying to work out, can we get phytoremediation to a sort of efficient enough level where people will start actually using it? Because it's pretty slow at the moment, but it's still very cool.
So what happens to the leaves? I guess they get scattered and it's not so intense?
The idea is you can... Yeah, they've looked at that. So if you get the wrong plant, it will just drop its leaves and then the heavy metal goes back into the soil. But if you get the right plant, you can actually sort of harvest it and then remove the metals from the environment that way. And, you know, there's some talk of even, you know, if you remove this, you know, the plant material with the metals, some of these metals are really quite precious metals. Could you extract the metal back from the plant material and recycle it that way? They call that one phytomining.
Like gold or something from an apple, or
gold would be ideal, but
well,
all sorts
do
of
get
things.
Gold out of our sewage system.
Mm. Oh yeah, people's rings that they've dropped.
No, the gold that we eat. It's in some foods and things. Like
oh
that.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
just
yeah.
goes through us and comes out.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's so inert.
It. Yeah, and they collect it because it's pure.
How do you collect it?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to ask Melbourne Water. We'll have to get them in and ask them. But they do actually have a chemical method of of breaking it down, just leaving the gold, because the gold doesn't break down.
Sure, exactly.
It just stays there. So, you know, once it's gone through the filters, it just there is gold sitting there. So they just collect it all up and sell it.
Mm, nice.
So you might have a gold tooth that comes from the Werribee.
That's an awesome thought.
So is soil something that you've studied throughout your whole career, or were you off on another track and thought, this is wrong, it should be dirt?
Okay, so I guess many, many moons ago I actually did an art degree and then I came back to science. So the short answer is no, it's not been my life's work. But all through my undergraduate career and leading up to this point, everything I've done has been about plant-microbe interactions. So that's, you know, pretty close to dirt. If a plant and a microbe are interacting, it's usually in dirt.
Do you garden?
Hmm?
Do you garden?
I love gardening, yes. What? You look at me like you don't believe me. I love gardening.
I can't believe anybody likes gardening.
Oh. Jim, you need to be more open-minded just because you don't like gardening.
Well, if I don't like it, that's a pretty good benchmark as far as I'm concerned.
That is quintessential, Jim. I love it. Jen, I've got a little bit of a question, a little bit left field, but hopefully still topical.
Okay,
to dirt,
sure.
And
okay.
Bacteria. So obviously there was a bit of excitement with the NASA announcement on Mars recently.
Sure, yeah.
Do you remember the conversation that that the scientists were mentioning that often when, you know, people jump the gun and was like, could it be life? There was a conversation about, well, you know, one of the most interesting things is that we could actually bring a bit of dirt to Mars, and then we could have actually brought a little bacteria or life there by mistake, because they're pretty tough critters, some of them.
They sure are. There are bacteria that have been shown to survive in the vacuum of space. So I think NASA are actually pretty careful about cleaning down like entire spaceships before they get them to leave.
And I was reading about the announcement. They won't let the Mars rover go around the surface of Mars at the moment because of the water, the flowing water. They've got it parked and it's not allowed to move in case it drops a bacteria off into the flowing water.
So no dirt on their boots then? No space dirt? No earth dirt?
No earth dirt,
but
no
there
space
might be some
dirt.
Space dirt here. Can you identify space microbes? Things that have been deposited by...
Oh, from an asteroid.
Something that's come from an asteroid. Without actually sort of just, I guess, getting an asteroid out of the asteroid belt and looking at the microbes on it. No, not. There's no sort of telltale signs about which microbes are alien life.
But you can tell, you know where meteors hit the Earth, and so you can find the meteoric rock. And
oh, for
like
sure.
That.
But I guess the question is, I mean...
Is there anything still left inside that is the remnants of
it would be very
space.
Hard to discern which micro...
Well, you know, if a challenge. You can come on next time and tell us.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess it would be very hard to discern, like, if what you find in or on that rock was picked up coming through the atmosphere.
I'm sure they had a program on the X-Files about that.
Probably. I'm sure it killed everybody.
I just was so impressed at how tough some of the organisms, microorganisms, can be.
Oh, my God,
Yeah. No. In my mind.
Have they let you into the Ranger Uranium Pit water pits in... Kakadu yet to see what organisms are living in those radioactive pits?
No, they have not, but maybe one day they will. So my boss used to work with uranium remediation using my little buddy Geobacter that I was telling you about before. So it doesn't just produce electricity, it can transform uranium that's in the water table and so that it drops out solid and they can collect it and clean up the soil that way. So maybe one day they'll pay us money to go up there and have a look, but not yet. No one's approached us yet.
That's a pretty impressive trait for a little bacteria.
Oh, sure.
So does that mean it can be used in, like, cleaning up nuclear sites, or is that kind of beyond its capabilities?
Maybe. Just maybe.
But these things can live in all sorts of, like, inside rock and inside and way down inside the dirt, can't
Absolutely,
they?
Yeah.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and this is our second birthday show, our second anniversary show.
We actually started
on the 7th of October 2013, didn't we?
Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
So it's actually in 2 days, but that's on a Monday, so it doesn't count. This is our 104th show.
And you can join the conversation that we are having by
SMSing
us on 0427 Joy 949 or emailing us on air at joy.org.au or calling.
Don't call
the front desk, because there isn't anybody out there at the moment. We would have to send Patrick or Claire out to answer the phone, and that would be too awful for words. So not for them, but for you. So, anyway, we've been just chatting with Jen Wiltshire from La Trobe, I think she was from, wasn't she,
yes,
Steph?
Yes, and now...
About dirt and remediation of soils through the use of bacteria and microorganisms. And we will get her back, I think, on the show sometime, because that was really quite interesting. And we are going to...
So we're now talking with Danny Davis. Are you there, Danny?
I am indeed. Hello.
Hello. And I hear you are a community radio pro, so welcome to Joy. Is this your first time on Joy?
It's my first time on Joy, it is.
It's great to have you. Thank you so much. So you're also a PhD student at La Trobe University, is that right?
That's right.
And your research is about innovation. So is Australia an innovative country? How are we going innovation-wise?
Ooh, there's a good question. Look, we are at some levels. I think naturally Australians are inquisitive troublemakers looking for new, easier, better ways of doing things.
Well, don't tell me the Hills Hoist is a sign of innovation.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with the Hills Hoist.
It's an Australian invention.
Do you know how many people have them? Lots. I don't know the number.
It was a great invention of its time, but I think we might have moved past it.
That's not innovative anymore.
No, things don't stay innovative for too long. People will catch up.
So what does make something innovative?
That's a good question. My area of research and my interest is in not so much the innovation itself, but about large organisations. And why are large organisations who have, you know, lots of money, really good staff, great brands, great reach, really awful at innovating and really frustrating places to work and really frustrated with themselves?
Lack of trust?
What are the barriers to innovation? Why aren't they able to make use of all of that skill and resources?
So the way I work on it is about the decision-making process of the organisation, kind of treating an organisation as a living system. How does it think? How does it work? How does it make decisions? And it's kind of the governance practices of the organisation. And what I look at is the fact that the way we make decisions in these organisations was designed for the types of projects that used to be good ones to find 20, 30, 40 years ago. They're not the good projects to find anymore, but that's what our process is, what our decision-making is good at finding and funding and nurturing. All those clever, innovative, fast-moving, learning projects, they just kind of get weeded out. So the challenge is to get the thinking and the logic of the organisation to be able to engage, I call it innovation-aware governance. How do you get the decision-making process of the organisation to engage with clever thinking, with new ideas, with radical ideas?
Isn't it about, it's Jim here, Danny, isn't it about identifying those people in an organisation who have got leading ideas, so the ones with a bit of vision, and allowing them space in which to move? Trusting people to actually do things that are not going to harm the organisation? Because, I mean, my experience in big organisations is that they're terrified if you come up with a new idea in case it goes wrong.
Yep, so there's a huge fear of failure. And I don't think it's really fair to put all of that onus on, well, you're clever, you take all the risks. That's kind of not scalable. It's not going to work. And who's to say who are the people with the best ideas and give them leeway? So, look, it is about creating space and getting out of their way, but it has to have some rules about it, because otherwise things will still go horribly wrong.
And
there are plenty of examples of projects that have just gone off the rails with no control. You can't let that happen.
So Danny, this is Patrick here. I'm curious to know, when you've been talking about how there's no limits, and I know that, Jim, you were curious about that, I'm wondering, is it one of those situations where if you put the sky's the limit, it almost becomes too overwhelming that people are unsure how to develop? So if you give people, not barriers, but certainly a smaller space in which to work, but still enough room to actually develop or be a little bit more entrepreneurial and innovative, it would allow probably a better gestation of these ideas?
Well, that's right. I think ideas need to develop. You don't get a brilliant, earth-shattering idea out of absolutely nowhere.
Oh, really?
Suddenly works.
I thought.
Well, you might get the idea, but you have to work on it. You have to develop it, and often you have to weed them out and get rid of them, and move on to the next one.
I just worked out how to do good showering. Oh well.
So one of the things that happens in these organisations is kind of this decision-making process and hierarchy and delegation of authority and all of these wonderful things that kind of mean that the really big, important, big projects go up to the board and get approved. But those big, huge projects, it kind of assumes that you know what's going to happen in the future. There's this fictional expectation of what's going to happen, and it just the world doesn't work that way. But they're making decisions as if it does.
I'm curious, Danny, what is your opinion of how hierarchical structures inside these certain companies, how do they progress innovation or do they hamper it?
At the moment, they're hampering it.
But how do you feel that they're hampering it?
I don't think it's just about the people. So, you know, you get people saying, oh, that company, you know, they're terrible, they're not following their opportunities, their managers aren't paying attention, their executives are hopeless, the board's full of fuddy-duddies, etc. I've been out there talking to these people through the work I'm doing through La Trobe, and you know, it's not necessarily true. Look, there are some people who fit that description, but mostly at all levels, they're really good people trying really hard to work with the information they've got. And it's not that they're hampering and holding people back. It's that they don't have the information in front of them to be able to engage with these projects in the right kind of way. You know, if you were given a decision to put multi-million dollars into some kind of project, you'd really struggle with it because most projects should build up to that point. And they don't get that information and insight to know what's building.
Well, that's called identifying the evidence, isn't it?
Well, people try. So the old way about doing it was to find something that's brilliant, large-scale, these big, enormous projects or mergers and acquisitions or huge investments and try and de-risk them. So they'd get into it and they'd analyse and they'd try and analyse it until there was no risk left. And that was the way about going. If you had a risk, if you had a project failure, that was because you were no good at analysing it. But the type of projects we get these days that need to be full of experimentation, full of development, full of learning. We know we want that learning in what we do, but our decision-making process doesn't support it. A project that has this risk just doesn't move ahead at all, whereas it should move ahead stage by stage on its merits.
I have heard some examples of where organisations have intentionally try to embed innovation in the culture. For example, when they have, okay, the last Friday of every month, you get the day off, you have to be at work, but working on whatever you like. Are these kinds of things working? Is that changing things? And what other good examples have you seen where it does work?
So, look, these things can work and can fail, so they're not a golden bullet answer. And a lot's been said about, I think that was originally called Google Free Time. They've very quietly withdrawn that, by the way.
Oh, can you tell us why, or is that not for radio scandal?
I think just because it didn't work.
Yeah, okay.
You know, there hasn't been a lot of press release about why it didn't work. But to just let people go off on ideas doesn't solve the problem of how do you work out which the good ones are? How do you take it from an idea that you did on a Friday and turn it into something that actually has 100 people on it or 1,000 people working on it or is going to make a huge economic impact? It's actually about taking things through a development process from concept right the way up to it's an operating business that you're continuing to develop and has you know, world-changing and business-changing implications.
But this sounds like you're working this from a very economic perspective and not from a learning perspective.
I'm trying to solve it from the systemic, why is it we have such a good ideas but don't do anything with them, rather than how can I come up with more ideas?
That might be innovative.
dangerous.
Hopefully, Danny. Danny, a big show, birthday show today. It's James here. My final question is on R&D and how that intersects with innovation, because it's obviously been reported that R&D in Australia is lower than other, you know, developed countries. Is there a link, and is there benefits to companies that do invest heavily in R&D?
Okay, that's a good one. And look, it depends on what you define innovation to be. I've got a very relaxed, liberal view of what that can be, and it's basically anything that is an investment in business improvement. It doesn't have to be a rocket science, brand new idea.
That's what indicates business improvement would be also another good question. Is it, as Jim's saying, economic improvement, or is it also the learning of the company to then develop ideas in the future and the culture?
Ah, okay, so it's all of these things. When you start to look, and this is one of the areas that I get into when we get all nitty-gritty technical about the whole thing, is...
Well, I'm prepared to have a big argument with you about this.
We don't have time.
We've got 20 seconds left.
20 seconds for what I was just about to go into. Multi-bottom line, environmental, social, human capital,
nonsense.
All these kind of things need to be measured. You need to be able to have a look at whether an idea is good across a whole range of different measures, not just financial.
Well,
financial is important. It's not the only one.
I think this is something that these guys are going to have to look back into in the future, Danny. But thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Pleasure. Thanks.
It's been absolutely wonderful. And I look forward to hearing a little bit more about your research in innovation.
That'd be great.
Thanks, Danny.
Thanks, Danny. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and it's 28 minutes past 10.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hello, you are on Joy 94.9. You are on Is Nothing Sacred, a very special episode of Is Nothing Sacred because it is our
second anniversary.
We haven't sung yet. Maybe that can be at the end. Maybe we can sing out at 10:59.
I was warned not to sing.
I think that indicates that don't you have to pay a license? Oh, no, that's actually been removed now, the copyright for Happy Birthday.
It's community radio, so we pay our license fees, so we're covered.
I know, but it's Happy Birthday. They're bound the person who had it, but actually it has been removed from that and it is now in the public domain. There
Excellent.
Was a recent court case about it, from what I heard.
Well, Patrick, as a singer, you and I can sing out at the end of the show, but in the meantime we have a message from one of our original gang presenters, Kurt. He says, "Hi, darlings. Happy second birthday to the best show on Joy." Aww.
How can he say that? What about his show?
Hopefully we can chat on the phone if I don't fall asleep. Yes, please text me or text us and we will give you a call. He does say, "Landscaping and 35 degrees is a drowsy cocktail. Love you all so much and the show is magnificent. Thank you for being the people to introduce me to radio and Joy. And always, Kurt, your trans son."
Aww. And here I was thinking that 35 degrees and manscaping was a drowsy cocktail. I think
35 degrees in manscaping sounds quite nice, really.
It does sound very nice. I'm curious to see what you've got lined up, Steph, in terms of the highlights, the clips. Yeah.
So I dug through the files. I picked some of my favourites.
Of course you did.
No, I've looked through. I agree with them very wholeheartedly.
So the first one we have is an interview, very long, possibly our longest interview. It's about 45 minutes. Jim and I just couldn't get enough of him. One of our favourite journalists.
Luckily, it isn't 45 minutes long tonight.
No, this is 2 minutes. Talking to Anthony Lowenstein, and he's actually talking about the Iraq war, but it could apply to Syria. So he's talking
about... He's in Afghanistan now.
He's
making
talking,
a film.
He's talking about the media representation of the war in Iraq, but I think it's very valid. So here you have, this is from last year, Anthony Lowenstein on Joy 94.9.
I often say to my editor at The Guardian, I feel like I've been writing the same thing for 10 years. What I mean by that is that I started writing about some of these issues around the 2003 Iraq war and with all the lies that were told around that particular issue. And one of the things that was very clear during that time is that so much of the press essentially blindly followed and accepted the bollocks that we were being fed by then the Howard government, the Bush administration, others. They all turned out to be untrue. And one of the things that I talked about actually in Prophets of Doom is the money-making that is going along with these wars. And I'm not suggesting that the Iraq war happened solely for, you know, three companies to make money. It's more sophisticated.
Well, Halliburton made a lot, didn't they?
And made a lot of money, and a lot of other companies did as well in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. So obviously it's a factor. I'm not saying it's the sole reason. But one of the things about the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, is that it allows there to be a constant sense of fear. So when you have various government officials and many of their followers in the press blindly repeating propaganda about, for example, there's always going to be a terror threat. I mean, let's think about the recent situation here in Australia. Until, a month ago, I don't think you would find pretty much very many Australians even hearing the term, you know, the word ISIS, which is the Islamic State in now partly occupying Iraq and Syria. This group's been around for a while. and they're an incredibly brutal, awful organisation. So I'm not for a second defending anything that they do. But the idea that suddenly we have gone from a group that virtually no one had heard of to being the greatest threat in the history of the world. I mean, last week our Attorney General, this sort of incompetent man known as George Brandis, comes out and says, the threat is worse than the Cold War. I mean, is the man serious? Is he seriously saying, well, I guess he was, for rhetorical sort of laughs, that the threat during the Cold War of a serious possibility of a nuclear exchange between the US and the Soviet Union, which at various times was feasible, is the same as a handful of undeniably brutal fanatics in the Middle East? It's absurd. So when you have that level of rhetoric, it's not surprising, and it's perpetuated by a lot of, you know, many in the press, it's not surprising that many in the public are scared.
Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're here on Joy 94.9 for Is Nothing Sacred. It's Patrick here, back with these guys as they celebrate their second year anniversary.
That was us celebrating, can you tell?
Wow, that's really...
We are all celebrating all the time.
Exactly.
That's our life.
Isn't that... Yeah, it is your life, says the man. I said, how are you doing? And his response was, I'm still alive. Morbid much. Anyway.
It is our 2 year anniversary.
It is our 2 year anniversary. And I'm very
104
glad,
shows.
104 shows. And I'm very glad that one of these 104 shows were discussing with Susanna Walters, who was a marvellous, marvellous
so
academic.
Good.
And I was the one who grabbed her. I was very happy. At the time, she was with the Northeastern University. We don't know if she's still there. Might be with Indiana now.
Yeah.
But at the time, she just released her book, The Tolerance Trap, discussing why Born This Way is considered a bit of an easy cop-out for the gay rights movement. Let's have a little listen.
The Born This Way ideology is also part of a larger way of thinking about everything as hardwired and predetermined in this way. And, you know, a sort of move against the kind of social construction views that many of us hold very dear. I think the other thing is it's easy. You know, it's an easy way for people to avoid actually thinking about the complexity of human sexuality. So if you just say, you know, oh, okay, you got to give people their rights because they're born that way. Well, it's a very tepid and silly argument for civil rights as far as I'm concerned, but it's an easy one for people to think about because then they don't have to think about sexuality. They don't have to think about desire. They don't have to think about choice. And in fact, they can still really hate gays because they can say, well, this is gross and disgusting and I hate it, but they can't help themselves. It's, you know, no one would choose to be gay. You know, God forbid anyone would choose to be gay. So part of what underlies the idea, and one of the reasons I find it such a dangerous idea, underlies the idea of Born This Way, is in fact that choice is a terrible idea, that no one would choose this. So all the ideas we've had in the gay movement about, you know, proud to be gay, you know, gay pride, gay freedom, a gay positivity, are eviscerated in the idea of Born This Way, because the assumption is, you know, this is something that is just predetermined and no one would ever choose this. Now, what's true, of course, is that I don't think any of us think of sexuality in the way we think of a choice, like I choose to wear these clothes today, or I choose to take this walk, or I choose to drink this particular beverage. I mean, clearly sexuality is something we feel, all of us feel and experience very deeply and as a deep part of ourselves. But that's very different. To say something is deep and a part of you need not mean that it's hardwired and predetermined.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
We're celebrating that. Community radio tonight because it is our 2 year anniversary.
And one of our regular listeners, Scotty, has sent us a message. And Scotty says, thanks, guys, really enjoying the program. Thanks, Scotty. We're really enjoying that you that you are listening. So,
oh, thank goodness that Scotty still listens to this. I thought he only listened to me. Damn you, Scotty. I thought that you loved all of the love.
He listens to us every week.
I thought that you loved me, Scotty.
Of course he does.
So we have one more clip. We're doing a few clips from the olden days, also known as 2014. And this is, do you want to talk about this clip, James? It was a very early morning. It was like, I feel like it was 5 a.m. It was probably like 9 a.m.
It was 7.
It was early. Anyway, and we were talking to?
To Claudia.
Claudia Astorino.
Astorino, that's the surname.
So she runs Organisation Intersex International in the US of A.
And her passion, look, Steph, you got very excited talking to her. She's she's so passionate and she does an amazing job. So
you can hear Steph frothing in this.
I became a fan because I read some of her articles on Autostraddle, which is an American queer women's website, and I'm a bit of a fan, which you can hear from my excitable radio voice. So here is Claudia Astorino.
So tonight on the show, we're talking to Claudia Astorino, who is the Associate Director of Organisation Intersex International USA. Hello, Claudia.
Hi, pleasure to be here. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for talking to us. We're very excited to have an international guest on the show.
I'm thrilled to be on the show.
To start things off, I mean, I'm 29 as well, and I didn't really know what intersex meant until I studied genetics at university. And so growing up, did you know what it meant to be intersex? How did you find out? What were your understandings as a child?
Yeah, so I found out things about intersex in bits and pieces. When I was 8, I was taken to an endocrinologist, and I was told that I didn't have a uterus, and that I wouldn't get a period, and that I wouldn't be able to have kids. But that was sort of out of context. It was sort of just, oh, you don't have a uterus. It wasn't connected to anything else. It wasn't until I was 16, when I started going to Johns Hopkins, that they told me, actually, you don't have a uterus because you are intersex. And in this form of intersex, you're not reproductive. So I found out then, although I actually also studied biology and genetics in university, and when I was there, I got a little bit more of an understanding of how complex the biology of sex development and everything actually is.
So I guess, you know, in terms of the different identities that you have, so I know from your Autostraddle article, you also identify as a gay lady. So how does how do those two?
I do strongly identify. As
me too. Yay for gay ladies!
That's right. Always.
So I guess sort of moving beyond the childhood period, and then, you know, kind of having a gay identity as well, how did those sort of different identities intersect?
So I figured out that I was interested in women long after I figured out that I was intersex. So when I was younger, I had a lot of I had to think a lot about what it meant to be intersex, and it wasn't really until college and the advent of the internet that I saw that there were positive understandings of what it meant to be an intersex person, that there were people that said that intersex isn't a medical condition that we need to be ashamed of and our bodies don't need to be fixed. Intersex is just a biological way of being, and we've got a mix of traits that are traditionally considered male and female in the same body, but you know what? We're part of the natural variation in what human bodies look like and function like. And I learned those positive perspectives and had a positive view of my intersex self then. It wasn't until later that I figured out that I was interested in women. And so for a while, I thought, okay, as I was exploring my identity, I didn't know that I was exclusively interested in women. And so because I identify as a lesbian, although a lot of people do ask me, you know, you're an intersex person, though. Can you actually identify as a lesbian? Because lesbian, like so many sexual orientation and gender identity labels, they assume that you start from a place where you're a typical biological male or female. Terms like straight, gay, cisgender, they start from a place where they don't assume that you're intersex. So because they don't make room for us, a lot of people ask me, you know, can you identify that way? Kind of in the same way that people ask, you know, can you use that word or phrase in that way? I think you're doing it wrong. And it's kind of like anyone can identify the ways that they want to. And, you know, sex isn't binary. Sexual orientation isn't binary. There's not just straight and gay. Gender identity isn't just male and female. There's a lot of options for how you can identify within those categories. So I don't think it's a big deal to say, well, then why do the combinations of how you identify across those categories have to be in a binary way?
All day, every day. Joy 94.9 on air and online at joy.org.au.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Hello, darlings. This is Miriam Margolyes asking you and ordering you to tune in to Joy 94.9, Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station. It's gorgeous.
Yes, thank you, Miriam. And this is Jim, and I'm on here on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's just 3 minutes to 11, and that means we're going to have to wrap up. And I've been on air tonight with Claire and James, who's pushing buttons, and Steph, who's been editing furiously to get all those fabulous interview clips. And we've got in the studio with us one of our original co-hosts, dear little Patrick.
Because
it's our 104th show.
You know, one day you'll get this right, won't you?
You're
still just the same as you used to be. I remember trying to get you to do something together and I failed miserably.
On the count of three, we can say 2 year anniversary. 1, 2, 3.
Two year anniversary. I must say, I think 140 shows almost sounds more impressive.
104 shows.
Oh, God.
Without a break.
I just added 30.
I remember the times that we had the choirs in the studios. I mean, that was fun. And it was Roxette.
I remember the time when you sang.
I did sing. I think I sang. Was it the last episode that I did with you guys permanently?
I think it was.
Yeah, I sang. I sang Yazoo.
It's and you nah. And you sang before you went off to host Lefty Pinko's.
Before I went off to host Lefty Pinko's, and then I hosted Rainbow Crusaders for this grid, which is taking a break, unfortunately, in the next grid. It is
That's
a huge show, but the podcasts are actually really incredible, if I do say so myself.
And if you want to hear us even more than you're hearing us in this hour, you can go and look at our podcasts, which are on joy.org.au. Go to the program grid, push on our show, and then push on podcasts.
Or easier, joy.org.au/isnothingsacred. And also joy.org.au/rainbowcrusaders, because I need to have my own little plug.
I discovered today that you can also search for guests' names within a show. So if there was one show you're like, oh, that show they did with such and such, with the Penguin Show, you can Google penguins.
Oh my gosh, you at the goddamn Penguin Show.
We've had two penguin shows.
Yeah, we have. Just quickly before we disappear, there is a couple of messages. First off, from the marvellous Eddie, happy anniversary, team. Great interviews. Lovely to hear Patrick again on Is Nothing Sacred.
Aww.
I love that I'm choosing the ones that reference me.
And we all love Eddie for obvious reasons.
Of course. And happy second birthday, and I still do love you, Patrick. Of course you do, Scotty. Why wouldn't you? One day we will have our Björk and Kate Bush fangirly hangout. Ha ha, Scotty X.
Scotty, invite all of us, Scotty.
We'll all have a great time, but we are out of it at the moment.
We are. So you have been listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
Next up, we have A Little Pot of Joy.
We do. And we next week, we're going to be talking arts funding with Esther Anatolitis from Regional Arts Victoria.
I'm looking forward to hearing about this with the whole thing about Mitch Fiefdom. This is Fiefdom.
Senator Mitch Fiefdom is the new Minister for the
Arts. And thanks to our guests, Jen Wiltshire and Danny Davis. We'll be back next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.